information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Tonight, we care.
Appear to border
it shows.
On fence.
The law?
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
The dream of the 90s is alive in Portland. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the 202nd episode of Media Monarchy. It's January 21st, 2011. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. This week, who's on first? The most favored nation and a glimpse of the future, Hollywood spending and media memes, Freeway, Ricky Ross, Reagan and Bush and the drug war, the news purge, you and me and the war of the end times, the contrived tree bomber plot, and Portlandia. All that and so much more, my friends. January 21st, 2011, episode 202 of MediaMonarchy.com.
Scores of innocents die, and the Andalusian tribe, setting the lay of Nebraska alight, till all that remains is the arms of the angel. Hetty Green, queen of supply side, Bonnie Bondrap, you know what I mean. On the road, it's well advised to follow your own bag. In the era that you were born. We'll be right back.
Calamity Song. That's brand new music from Portland, Oregon's own The Decemberists. From their brand new record, The King is Dead. A sly reference to The Smiths, The Queen is Dead. And of course, frontman Colin Malloy, huge Morrissey fan as myself. Their new record on first quick listen seems like a nice back-to-basics approach after the grandiosity of their previous record, The Hazards of Love. That record is just coming out, bringing more attention to Portland, Oregon, and we, of course, have the debut on IFC tonight of Portlandia, starring Carrie Brownstein, ex of Slater Kinney. And they all shop at my store. We're going to end this episode with a brief note on Portlandia. But welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is episode 202 for MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com. It's January 21st, 2011, and we're coming to you live, as always, Friday mornings, 10 a.m. Pacific time, from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. And of course, none of this would be growing as much as it is and getting far beyond my control in some ways if it weren't thanks to the affiliates who syndicate, archive, rebroadcast, or even broadcast live right now, like ZeroPointRadio.com, worldwide, on the web, and on the AM and FM in Casper, Wyoming, 92.3 FM and 1670 AM. Hello, Casper, Wyoming. Welcome aboard. On the east side of the United States, the worldwide home of free speech, down in Florida, revereradio.net. Huge thanks to Rob Revere and revereradio.net. And then Free Radio Olympia, 89.5 FM in Olympia, Washington, frolympia.org. 104.1 FM in Berkeley, California, berkeleyliberationradio.net. 90.7 FM in Kisilov, Alaska, KWMD, thanks to oneskyradio.com. Thanks to CJSF.ca on 90.1 FM in British Columbia for broadcasting NewWorldNextWeek.com, my weekly video series with James Corbett. We also want to thank 89.9 FM in La Mesa, Texas, Patriot Radio. We want to thank Ground Zero Radio in Canton, Georgia, KBOO.info, and my man Glenn from right here in Portland, Radio23.org, and my man Jeff, also from here in Portland. And of course, you need to tune in and not drop out and join the growing community at tragedyandhope.com. And of course, you can get in touch and share in the Media Monarchy Kingdom any number of ways. Facebook.com/Media Monarchy and on and on. MySpace, Twitter, YouTube, Podomatic, Ustream, Blip, Cafe Press. You can send me an email, MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. A lot of folks can't seem to find it. It's up right on the top right of the page. I'm not trying to hide it. Yahoo works as well. We're on Skype, Instant Messenger, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org. And I would implore you, if you find independent, non-commercial, alternative media valuable and enriching, please donate. Your support helps keep Media Monarchy going and growing. And as we're trying to grow the kingdom, we're not trying to get rich off this. We just want to break even. The domain names, the Skype credit, the DJ dues, any little fix-its, adapters and cords, and any of those kind of things that pop up. So please, and to further drive that home, I didn't get any donations the previous week, so let me put the call out again for your help in keeping all this going. GoDaddy's bugging me about domains coming up for renewal. So one of the things I want to say right here at the top of the show is over the past several months, even I think going back to April of 2010, we started to use Ustream to stream live video of the show here from within the studio. And over those months, I incorporated it more, added more bells and whistles, and reached the point where last week I think it looked and sounded the best that it ever had, using some of the graphics and putting the text up on the screen and higher quality video. However, all of those things merely led to the complete destruction of the stream coming from Portland Radio Authority. So ultimately, if it's a live show and I'm wrecking the stream for the folks out there carrying it live, there's not a whole lot of point in doing that. So I believe what we're going to do, and at least what we're going to do for the present, and what we did earlier this morning from here in the studios, is record a B-side episode as a multimedia presentation. And that's what I did, and those videos are over on Ustream right now, and they'll show up later on YouTube.com/MediaMonarchy. And again, if you subscribe, you won't miss a thing. All those things will come to you. So needless to say, we are not streaming any video for this episode 202, and I got to tell you, it's a little bit of a relief. It's a lot of plates to spin, and by no means do I want to stop doing the video feed, but I don't want to do it at the cost of what was the original mission of all this in the first place, is doing a live radio show. So perhaps my wings were singed a little bit and will back off. But, you know, if time and technology were no object, and we'd love to get to that point, if we can grow this and do this live show with all of the audio, video, and the bells and whistles and tie in all those things. Perhaps it all won't work out exactly as I'd like it to, but that's the process. I think something else that happens in trying to spin all those plates, as I was doing last week on the live show, and in probably some of the recent previous episodes as well, I miss key points. I make silly mistakes. Silly, like saying the wrong actor that's in the Howl film. But more serious, like getting the whole blood libel thing incorrect. And those are the things that come to me in the days that follow those shows, where it comes to, oh God, no, I got that wrong. And a plate drops. So needless to say, it's kind of a relief not to have the video plate spinning right at the moment. But again, I implore you to check out YouTube.com/MediaMonarchy. I'm sure some of you don't even know that we've been doing tons of videos that are over there. And I think that's enough about all of that. We glance at Google News to see what's breaking on this Friday morning, January 22nd, 2011. Gabriel Giffords begins trip to Houston, leaving Tucson for rehab in Houston. The soap opera goes on. And of course, we've discussed Arizona assassination memes in the previous week. Meanwhile, the man commonly referred to as President Obama visits Schenectady. He's also tapped GE CEO Immelt to a new jobs creation economic board. Meanwhile, Lebanon's Druze leader backs Hezbollah, and of course all the other things in the news about Eric Schmidt and Google and Tunisia and Somali pirates and, yes, even Natalie Portman. So we'll keep that tab open. We'll keep tabs on the breaking news. And we'll get into it with more media in the monarchy. For Hollywood, it was a tough 2010 as spending continued to fall. This comes from the LA Times, and this gets into those areas of, I think, positivity or some kind of hopeful prospects for what's coming in a new financial world order. And to put it simply, it would be stop giving money to multinational corporations that lie and kill you, lie to you and kill you, and perhaps kill others. Maybe not directly, softly. and we can put it back into our own community, whether that's our own food, our own bands, our own entertainment. That's going to be the way we're going to emerge. Because they're pulling the rug out. They're burning the building down. But I digress. But let's put it into perspective. To paraphrase Apollo 13 astronaut Jack Swigert, Hollywood, we have a problem. The industry that was supposed to be immune to economic downturns looks like it's going to have some re-entry problems as the economy begins to recover. Broad swaths of the entertainment business declined in 2010. DVD sales were off 13%. Music sales, music CD purchases, plummeted 19%. Video game sales as well as concert and theater attendance also fell. Even the turnout for America's favorite pastimes, baseball and NASCAR, was down. And swift changes in technology will make it difficult for Hollywood to capture pre-recession levels of revenue. So much for the value of escapism. But perhaps most ominously, last summer, the pay television industry suffered an unprecedented net loss for the first time of customers, a yellow warning light that consumers may no longer regard cable TV as a must-have utility on par with electricity and phone service. Cable and satellite subscriptions, DVD sales, and video rentals long have been the profit pillars that supported Hollywood. Although media executives continue to boast content is king, recently released year-end data suggests entertainment companies are vulnerable to the same disruptive forces that imperil the music and newspaper industries. The studio and the content companies have become increasingly aware of the problem, but they seem collectively paralyzed about what to do about it, said Craig Moffat, analyst with Sanford C. Bernstein & Company. 2010 now looks to be a watershed year in the confluence of two powerful trends. The first of those forces, technology, is enabling people to get entertainment in cheaper and easier ways, and the second, the anemic economy, widening the gulf between the haves and the have-nots, making it tougher for some consumers to justify paying for cable or tossing a new DVD in the shopping cart. Right now is the tale of two cities, Moffat said. On the high end, people can't go upmarket fast enough, he said, referring to affluent consumers who are buying the latest in mobile phones, portable tablets, or internet-connected TV sets. Then you have this other half of the country that's being largely ignored in this discussion. Now, Moffat mentions A Tale of Two Cities, which reminds me of how Webster Tarpley has put our current recession, as they're calling it in the mainstream media. It is a depression. It could very well be, as forecasters such as Gerald Celente have called, the greatest depression. A Tale of Two Cities reminds us of this sort of Dickensian cruelty that's going down under the auspice of austerity. The first of those forces, technology, is enabling people to get entertainment in cheaper and easier ways. And I would like to think what we're doing here, enabled by this Gutenberg revolution, is giving you infotainment cheaper and easier. Cheaper like free. And easier like if you have an internet connection, you can get some piece of media from MediaMonarchy.com. For Hollywood, it was a tough 2010. And we remind you, we do have flashback links because we covered the story. Last August, pay TV subscriptions fall for the first time ever in U.S. And the more recent update, just from earlier this year, Americans watched more television than ever in 2010. Both of those we referenced on previous episodes of NewWorldNextWeek.com. Posted under this story, related media meme updates for you. The first from allgov.com, where they note, more people follow Lady Gaga on Twitter than live in Israel. I'll leave it to you to ponder why they would pick Israel as being the comparison. Certainly there's probably a state or something, but there you go. Arcade Fire, Kanye West, Kings of Leon lead the lineup for Coachella, the yearly festival held on Indian burial grounds and military bases with Octopus Connections. Yes, that's right. One of the biggest yearly concert festivals, Coachella, happens in Indio, California. And yes, Native American burial grounds and former military bases that even connects to the Octopus. Danny Casolaro, Michael Riconosciuto, Inslaw, Promise Software, Iran-Contra. Those are the kind of things that Peter Lavenda, I believe, gets into in Sinister Forces. Not that I believe, I know he does. I've read the books. You must as well. And, of course, go back and check out what is still, to this day, the most popular download from Media Monarchy, and that's my interview with Peter Lavenda of Sinister Forces. The confluence of prisons and military bases in this country that are built on Native American burial grounds. The idea that if there are holy sites and holy grounds in the world, well, couldn't there also be unholy sites? I'd love to go to Coachella. I even thought about it even when I lived on the East Coast now 5.5 years ago. But when you crunch the numbers, it's just not worth it. It's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars just to get in, and then you got to get there, you got to camp, you got to eat, and all of that crap. Sure, there are a bunch of great bands on there I would like to see, but I'd rather go see 20 small shows in a club where I could meet the band and talk with them afterwards and save money. Fox News asking, will internet radio kill the FM radio star as technology moves more and more towards internet radio? Will those corporations that, of course, cannibalize everything and take our ideas and take our energy and even take our airwaves that supposedly belong to the people, gobble it all up and sell it back to us? With the lowest common denominator, dumbing it down, race to the bottom, content that's king. I suppose I could have put this next one on Cyberspace War, but here it is right here in the media memes. Miss Nebraska, before she went on to win the Miss America pageant, took a little opportunity to slam WikiLeaks and the damage it's done to our national security. More on that from New York Daily News. An interesting story, and there are two different articles that I have linked up, both for you, from the Los Angeles Times. Killing of zebras near Hearst Castle stirs controversy, and I add the name Citizen Kill. Along with hairpin curves and heart-stopping views of the Pacific, motorists on California Highway 1 near the town of San Simeon may catch a glimpse of a most exotic sight, a herd of 5 dozen zebras grazing in the pastures along the road. They are what is left of what was at one time the world's largest private zoo, a menagerie of camels, kangaroos, emus, and giraffes that roamed the sprawling estate of newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst. Most of the animals were sold off in the 1930s, but the zebras remained on the Hearst Ranch and multiplied. They've been known to wander. Last week, 3 zebras, a buck, a mare, and a yearling, escaped from the 128-square-mile ranch and wandered down California Highway 46. On Wednesday, 2 of them turned up in a pasture on David Fiscalini's cattle ranch, where he told the San Luis Obispo Tribune they spooked his horses, so he raised a shotgun and killed them. The same day, another rancher shot the 3rd zebra at a ranch nearby. Many people in rural communities believe a rancher has a right to defend his livestock against intruders, no matter how rare the animals are. But Fiscalini's actions the next day raised eyebrows. On Thursday, he called a local taxidermist and asked him to come out to the ranch. He said he needed someone to skin the zebra and tan the hide so he could make a rug. You can't believe the controversy, said Rosemary Anderson, whose husband is that taxidermist. It breaks my heart to see it killed because it's wanton waste, she said. It's very sad that it wasn't handled in a different manner, but this rancher felt what he was taking care of was his property and getting rid of a predator. Stephen Hearst, the great-grandson of William Randolph Hearst, said he was shocked to learn about the killings. He said the zebras rarely venture outside the fence that surrounds the Hearst Ranch, but from time to time they do, and neighbors give us a call, and we retrieve them. The other article is called Shooting of Escaped Hearst Ranch Zebras Prompt Outcry, and anything that relates to Hearst, and maybe even more so, Citizen Kane, I find fascinating and will probably always cover here on Media Monarchy. Further down the memes, and perhaps a little more important, yes, we did have the Golden Globes this past Sunday night. However, CourthouseNews.com reporting PR guys say Golden Globes fired them for fighting payola. Longtime publicists for the Golden Globes claim the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which owns the awards, defamed and fired them after they warned the press association to stop taking payola bribes in exchange for nominations and votes. CinePoint Productions and the Michael Russell Group demand $2 million for defamation, fraud, interference, and other charges. Co-plaintiffs Michael Russell and Stephen LaCascio claim that during their 17 years of employment with the award show, they repeatedly urged the HFPA President Philip Burke, B-E-R-K, to end the shady practices and open up the membership to legitimate journalists. They say Burke refused to do so because he and the Press Association were profiting from the existing arrangements. Burke is also named as a defendant. According to the complaint in Superior Court, Russell and LaCascio were aware that many HFPA members abuse their positions and engage in unethical and potentially unlawful deals and arrangements, allowing its members to improperly profit from their association with the Hollywood Foreign Press Association and the Golden Globes. These deals and arrangements include, but are not limited to, accepting money, per diem, lavish vacations, junket lodging, gifts, and other perks each year provided by studios and producers in exchange for support or votes in nominating or awarding a particular film, and selling media credentials for profit in the form of space on the red carpet to low-profile or unknown media entities to cover the Golden Globes, and selling tickets and other membership privileges for the show. End quote. The Golden Globes show, which was held this past Sunday, is a heavily promoted, heavily covered movie industry event. Russell and LaCascio claim that to bolster the event's credibility, in December 2009, they helped Chrysler and charity organizer Stars for a Cause sign up A-list celebs for a publicity tour and auction to raise money for Haiti's earthquake relief. But the publicists say when Burke didn't get the kickbacks he expected from the auction, he retaliated against them and Stars for a Cause. Burke was upset as he wanted to receive benefits directly from Chrysler, and Stars was only given the proceeds from the charity campaign to charity and not to Burke. Shock upon shocks. Hollywood is corrupt. It began that way with gangsters and ultimately magicians. That's why it's Hollywood. Or the Holly branch. Casting the spell. I realize it may seem hypocritical, or at least to myself sometimes, to rail against these things and expose these things, because ultimately when it comes down to it, I'm a huge film buff and media pop culture guy. And always have been. Maybe a lot of it comes down to the fact that I wasn't allowed to buy music or go to movies growing up. Till I was about 9 or 10, but once the floodgates opened, it was off to the races. And so I've always gobbled up liner notes and production credits and all of those things. But needless to say, we shouldn't be shocked with tales of corruption. So you could just change some of the names and change the settings of that story, and it really wouldn't make that big damn bit a difference. Private sector and contracts and kickbacks and bribes and payola and junkets. Whether it's lobbyists and our Congress critters or Hollywood and all the sniveling sycophants there. It's how they roll. But to bring us back to the main story, it was a tough 2010. We can make it even tougher for them in 2011 by not giving them their money. More importantly, not giving them our money. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Just don't look. An interesting piece from the New York Times, which I saw in the Dirty Live print edition on break at work a few days ago. News is power in Washington, and aides race to be well-armed. showing the mass amounts of young folks who work as bootlicking aides, commuting to work at 4:30 in the morning, scouring the Twitterverse and blogosphere and news world to gather up important bits of news that they then synthesize and put in a report for when their middle manager rolls in. Whether they're working at accounting firms or congressional offices or the Chamber of Commerce. That's definitely an interesting one to at least peruse. We'll end this media memes posting with perhaps the worst note of all of this. It had been building for quite some time. It had been coming. Surely you had some emails and perhaps you even signed an online petition or posted links or made some kind of reference to it. And it even seems kind of unbelievable that a company so seemingly new would gobble up a company seemingly so long-standing. But this is where we are in 2011. Comcast merges with NBC.
After nearly a year's courtship, the marriage of Comcast and NBC has been given the FCC's blessing.
The Justice Department and the Federal Communications Commission did attach conditions, though. Regulators are trying to guard against this new company using its size and strength to stifle competition.
In just more than a month, the resulting company will combine broadcast and cable channels, local TV stations, a film studio, and America's biggest cable outfit to rival Disney for the title of world's biggest media firm. But is it good for the consumer? First, a vision of what the new company might look like and try to achieve. Here's CNBC.
They are going to go after ESPN and make NBC a major sports producer. They're going to bid for the Olympics, maybe for the next four Olympics in a package deal. And the real fear that they have is over-the-top television, streaming video, and Comcast is really well-positioned. They're the largest internet service providers in the country with 17 million subscribers. They'll win there.
This deal is complex. There are 25 pages of conditions alone on this deal. Among the specifics, Comcast agrees to divest itself of governance in Hulu while maintaining an ownership stake, and it promises not to slow or interfere with consumers' access to competing stations or channels for 7 years. Complex as the details are, The Atlantic says there is one very simple overarching goal. Today, a computer company such as Apple, a web company such as Google, a cable company such as Comcast, telephone wireless companies such as Verizon and AT&T, and newcomers such as Netflix all want to become the same thing. The folks that you turn to when you want to watch something, any place, any time, on any screen, ranging from your iPhone to your 52-inch plasma TV. But the FCC conditions largely ignore addressing the growing rift between broadcast outlets and cable providers over payments for television content. The Economist notes, that's a big whiff. These disputes have become increasingly fractious in the past couple of years, with channels periodically disappearing from television sets as media firms and distributors fail to agree prices. They are likely to become downright vicious as broadcast firms like ABC and Fox push for more retransmission fees from cable and satellite firms. Other analysts complained the FCC has simply become a rubber stamp organization. Propose a merger, any merger, it's likely to be approved.
And there you have it. Controlling both ends of the spectrum. As we're closing out those media meme stories, and we noted the buying up of the supposedly public airwaves, as was noted in the chat room over on ZeroPointRadio.com, is that you'd have to be a multimillionaire just to try and buy back those frequencies. It was always interesting back east at our college radio station that the only time there was any talk about someone wanting to buy our frequency, it was only ever from a religious organization. Because they got the dough, yo. I'd also like to think, hopefully, that now since the digital television conversion has happened, and again, I'm not as technologically minded to know exactly how all this stuff works. That's my dirty secret about all my media love, is that I'm really not a gear guy. I've really never cared about different kinds of gear and the model numbers and what's the hottest new thing. Now, I recognize I lack just the under-the-hood kind of fix-it abilities, and I'd like to grow that a little bit more. But I've always been more interested in the content that's coming through. No, I don't know how to make a microphone like Joe Rogan joked. Probably never would. I'm more interested in the content coming down the pipe. What I'm trying to say is with the digital television conversion, I'd like to think, hopefully, that some awesome technologically and progressively minded folks out there are working on pirate TV, using those analog TV spectrums that now aren't doing anything, as far as I know. Let's get on there. Let's get pirate TV going. Media Monarchy would gladly plant a flag in that. So we'll now turn to what is obviously probably the biggest soap opera headline grabbing going on in this past week. And it's, of course, the first story we cover on the latest New World Next Week episode. Who's on first? West welcomes most favored nation, glimpses future. Obama formally welcomes Chinese President Hu Jintao. We take the report from the Los Angeles Times. However, this is the text that I read on the latest episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com. And again, you can get that from that address. You can go straight to YouTube.com/CorbettReport. We're going to flesh out some of the other articles as I've added other updates to the goings-on of our paymasters and elites and frontmen and stooges and multi-generational serial killers. All of those things we're going to flesh out. Let's just listen to a brief clip of the vaunted press conference with Barry Satoru and Hu Jintao.
President Hu, members of the Chinese delegation, on behalf of Michelle and myself, welcome to the White House. And on behalf of the American people, welcome to the United States. At a time when some doubt the benefits of cooperation between the United States and China, this visit is also a chance to demonstrate a simple truth. We have an enormous stake in each other's success. In an interconnected world, in a global economy, nations, including our own, will be more prosperous and more secure when we work together. History shows that societies are more harmonious, nations are more successful, and the world is more just when the rights and responsibilities of all nations and all people are upheld, including the universal rights of every human being.
I have come to the United States to increase mutual trust, enhance friendship, deepen cooperation, and push forward the positive, cooperative, and comprehensive China-U.S. relationship for the 21st century. As we enter the second decade of the 21st century, the people of both China and the United States want to see further progress in our relations. Under the new circumstances and in the face of new challenges, China and the United States share broad common interests and important common responsibilities. We should adopt a long-term perspective, seek common ground while reserving differences, and work together to achieve sustained, sound, and steady development of our relations. I hope that through this visit, our two countries will advance the positive, cooperative, and comprehensive relationship and open a new chapter in our cooperation as partners.
And of course, it's all going according to plan. As James Corbett elucidates so much more eloquently and intelligently than I can, what's really going on here, this agenda that's been at play for quite some time, and of course it traces back to the Rockefellers and other moneyed elites and bloodlines. Who highlights need for cooperation? Questions dollar. That's from the Wall Street Journal, and we also referenced that on the latest New World Next Week episode. So again, I implore you to go get that and share it, download it, spread it. It's the nice bite-sized way to get this kind of information out for folks who aren't going to listen to a two-hour podcast. Further down the updates, who's on first? West welcomes most favored nation and glimpses the future. China ups cyber war stakes. That is from cyberspacewar.com. Just a little reminder of many of our other sister sites in the Media Monarchy Kingdom growing by the week. You'll have to go back to episode 201B to find out the latest member in the media monarchy family. But what we want to get into first, in greater degree, is an article from Grist. And it's not coming from someone who I'm thinking is singing the praises necessarily of all these things. I think that's why this article is kind of important, with the things that it shows you and how this is the plan. So many of the things that we talk about in the overarching control grid, the eugenics agenda, all of the things that these bloodline elites have talked about and written about for each other in their own literature that you were never supposed to read, like The Open Conspiracy or The New World Order or Tragedy and Hope. China's biggest cities grow its greenest citizens. China's rapid modernization and transformation into a fully fledged industrial nation make the country a little bit like the most enormous science experiment of the 21st century. The shift from a mostly rural population to a predominantly urban one, which took generations to accomplish in the United States, has happened essentially overnight. As in a time-lapse movie, this sped-up process makes certain trends that might be imperceptible at a slower speed instead become impossible to ignore. While it's easy to see the environmental dark side of urbanization, researchers have just added another dimension to the picture. According to a recent study published in Environmental Conservation, the rapid urban development that is creating many of China's environmental problems could also be the key to solving them. That's because cities are kind of like laboratories themselves, places where human behavior is shaped and molded by constant pressures, tensions, and incentives, and where change is accelerated. This study, led by scientists at the Center for Systems Integration and Sustainability at Michigan State University, found that the people who live in large Chinese cities are more environmentally aware and significantly more likely to act on that awareness than those in other smaller cities and towns. There's no question that China's rapid change has come at a heavy price. Pollution of every sort is rampant. Hundreds of years of cultural heritage have been wiped out in urban renewal projects. Millions of people have been displaced and entire ecosystems flooded by massive dams. Water shortages and traffic problems are mounting, and perhaps most frighteningly, in a nation where memories of widespread famine are still just under the surface, the prospect of food insecurity is always lurking in the background as arable land gets paved over, built up, and degraded. But the CSIS study suggests that in large cities, people's awareness and attitudes about those problems is heightened and can be focused into action, especially in the workplace. A press release from the National Science Foundation on these findings says, quote, "The researchers say companies in big cities likely have resources to promote environmental initiatives such as education. These companies can organize or provide support for organizing pro-environmental behavior and encourage, and under many circumstances require, employees to participate in environmental behavior. In addition, people who live in the largest cities are more widely exposed to media reports about the environment than people who live in smaller cities." The study's findings dovetail interestingly with physicist Jeffrey West's theory about the value of cities as incubators for human ingenuity, which has gotten a lot of play recently. West's research suggests that bigger cities are more efficient when it comes to resource consumption and also, perhaps most or more importantly, that they are more effective in fostering human collaboration and innovation. The types of behavioral change the new Chinese study looks at are on a relatively small scale, but they may offer an insight into how to change the minds of millions, and quickly. China's biggest cities grow its greenest citizens. If that doesn't shed some light just on this overarching social engineering scheme that's been going on, that again, I can only just kind of brush upon, that should spark a little bit more research into what's been going down. China plants its image on Times Square. This original article seemed to disappear, and I only found a report from peopleforum.cn out of China. Meanwhile, perhaps quite ominously, China moves troops into North Korea, and then the other surrounding the show of state. Who's on first? Senator Harry Reid calls Hu Jintao a dictator. Meanwhile, Gibbs, the outgoing White House press secretary, defended Jintao's state visit invite. Admiral Mike Mullen's wife faints during the ceremony welcoming the Chinese president. But to flesh out what we're seeing and to go along with the photo we have posted up for you with the Chinese flag and the American flag posted on a lamppost, and you can even see it's Constitution Avenue in the District of Criminals. Meet the new boss. China owns us, or owns the U.S. From Paul Joseph Watson, the flags along Constitution Avenue tell you everything you need to know. America's been sold out, and our new Chinese slave masters are now leading the sheep to slaughter. Even as Obama bows and fawns to President Hu Jintao, the globalists for whom he fronts are sharpening the knives and preparing to unleash the bloodletting as the dying carcass of America is dragged into line to facilitate the global management of the planet. Not satisfied with a hemorrhaging trade deficit with China that continues to bleed American jobs at a rate of millions, a crumbling manufacturing base being replaced by the endless import of cheap slave goods from the communist state, and a stunted economy being rapidly outpaced by the Red Dragon, the Obama administration wanted to further drill it into Americans who the new boss is by placing Chinese flags throughout D.C. before Obama's fawning meeting with unelected President Hu Jintao. Everyone's painfully aware of the fact that China now owns the United States economically, with the Chinese central bank being the largest debt holder at approaching $1 trillion. The average American family with two kids collectively owes around $12,000 to China. The communist state's ownership of long-term U.S. Treasury securities means the U.S. pays upwards of $100 million a day to China in terms of interest alone. China's huge accumulation of U.S. dollars gives it the sway to lead the U.S. by the nose like a sheep to the slaughter, holding in its hands the power to decide the economic destiny of the now collapsing American empire. The culmination of this process moved a step closer this week when Hu Jintao made it clear that China was preparing to sharpen the knife for the bloodletting to begin by deriding the dollar as a product of the past. That would be the aforementioned Wall Street Journal article where he questions the dollar, and signaling its replacement with a new global monetary system based around the Chinese yuan. It may not be exactly that, but we do know they are killing the dollar by design. The figures don't lie. After a 20-year process of gradual sellout overseen by Clinton, Bush, and now Obama, China now owns America. One of the things mentioned in Obama's Wall Street Journal op-ed, where he moves to the right on regulation, which again, this is where your progressive Changeluya hero goes to get information out. He writes an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal. This is the same question I would ask about anti-establishment hackers who want to whistleblow. They go to the New York Times, the home of Judith Miller. But the Obama side has a new executive order that ties in with this op-ed PR piece. The executive order is called Improving Regulation and Regulatory Review. And his op-ed piece is something like Towards a New Regulatory World Order, something like that. Our other China-related news bit should, again, flesh this out for you to show you exactly what we're facing. January 14th from the New York Times, solar panel maker moves work to China, aided by at least $43 million in assistance from the government of Massachusetts and an innovative solar energy technology. Evergreen Solar emerged in the last 3 years as the third largest maker of solar panels in the United States. But now the company is closing its main American factory, laying off the 800 workers by the end of March, and shifting production to a joint venture with a Chinese company in central China. Evergreen cited the much higher government support available in China. The factory closing in Devens, Massachusetts, which Evergreen announced earlier this week, set off political recriminations and finger-pointing in Massachusetts, and it came just as President Hu Jintao of China scheduled for a state visit to Washington, where the agenda is likely to include tensions between the U.S. and China over trade and energy policy. Third largest maker of solar panels in the U.S. moves Massachusetts factory to China. Does this tie in to the coming eugenics agenda and control grid compact cities? Of course, we all want to be green. But we'll even fix it to where you're still paying the banksters and the gangsters. They've got the next box set up for you. Oh, I'm getting outside the box, man. I'm going to get solar. Screwing us every way. And it goes on. Some of the other things that flesh this story out, of course, is that after the hoopla in Washington, Hu Jintao went to Chicago. He needs to hook up with the corrupt Chicago gangster syndicate, which is where this current middle management puppets that are running the show right now, Obama and Rahm and the Dailies, the Chicago Climate Exchange, Annenberg Challenge, all of those corrupt, dirty dealings, which a couple of years ago now, Webster Tarpley went into quite great detail, even calling out the Blagojevich scandal before it happened in his book, Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography. So they come to D.C. for the show, but then they move off to Chicago for the dirty dealings. Our related geopolitical updates. One note on the recent uprising in Tunisia, which I'll remind you again, the latest Sunday update episode from Corbett Report on the Tunisian situation points and shows quite well the involvement of Open Society Institute, George Soros, and again, the same elites that fund revolutions. It's not as clumsy, perhaps, as was done by the CIA in decades past. There's a lot of cover. There's a lot of left cover. And there's a hell of a lot of plausible denial. But from the Daily Mail, Tunisian president's wife fled that coup with basically $50 million in U.S. money in gold bars. So even as they're fleeing the country they've helped destroy, they're still grabbing stuff on the way out. The entitlement of these elites, which, as we just noted a few minutes ago, are a lot of times not even elected. They are generally selected. But our last bit of geopolitical updates all surround one story that, again, things are speeding up. Things are moving rapidly. There's a great guy I work with who's really astute, really intelligent, and probably, fortunately for him, spends more time reading books than paying attention to the insane world of news. But when I mentioned to him the other day that, Jesus, can you believe that Baby Doc came back to Haiti? He said, what? Jean-Claude Duvalier, Baby Doc, son of Papa Doc, has returned from exile, 25 years in exile in France, returned at this opportune moment to Haiti, undergoing disputed elections, undergoing a cholera epidemic brought on by UN troops, and of course still trying to clean up from the earthquake. Just give your cash to Bush and Billy. Baby Doc showed up out of nowhere And the first I heard of it was late night looking at my Twitter feed, which again will remind you folks, since I recently got a Wi-Fi pod, we're doing a hell of a lot more on twitter.com/MediaMonarchy. I first heard about this from Naomi Klein, author of No Logo and The Shock Doctrine. And she said something to the effect of, the most disturbing thing is that he's not in handcuffs as Baby Doc returns to Haiti. But a couple days later, at least, fortunately, but this may be all part of the process and all a part of the show, Haitian police took ex-dictator Duvalier to court, brought him before a Haitian court. So we have stories from the Washington Post, from the Voice of America, and Time.com, but let's get a brief clip to break down this story from the Associated Press. Baby Doc back in Haiti after 25 years in exile.
Amid a crush of people and a barrage of flashbulbs, former Haitian dictator Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier returned to Haiti after being forced into exile nearly 25 years ago. It's a surprising move as Haiti tries to recover from last year's earthquake and move forward politically. In fact, it was not immediately clear why Duvalier chose this moment to return. He arrived on an Air France jet and left Haiti's airport without making a statement to reporters. However, hundreds of his supporters gathered outside a fence at the airport, chanting his name and clapping exuberantly. 25 years ago, when he drove to the airport and went into exile in France, Haitians danced in the streets at the end of an uprising against his brutal dictatorship. In the fall of 2007, Haiti's president told reporters that Duvalier could return to the country, but would face justice for thousands of people killed during his rule and millions of dollars stolen from Haiti. Sunday, there were no immediate protests against him. Brian Thomas, The Associated Press.
So I quickly, during that brief clip, which hopefully would just give you the briefest rundown if you're unfamiliar with this dictator and the situation going on, but I jumped over to grab the latest update I can find for you 48 minutes ago from The Guardian. List of charges against Baby Doc continues to grow. Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier has slipped out of his hotel and moved to a private house overlooking Port-au-Prince, but the list of charges for abuses during his dictatorship of Haiti continues to grow. Duvalier left the upmarket hotel through a rear exit yesterday while his partner, Veronique Roy, distracted journalists by walking out the front, enabling a discreet move to the hillside residence. It may prove a brief respite because judicial proceedings gathered momentum today after an announcement from Amnesty International that authorities are investigating alleged crimes against humanity during the former dictator's 1971 to 1986 rule. Investigating Jean-Claude Duvalier for the human rights crimes committed during his time in power is a massive step forward, Gerardo Ducos, Amnesty's Haiti researcher, said. What we need to see now is a swift and impartial process in line with international standards that truly brings justice for those who have been waiting for too long. So I can't exactly say what he was intending to do. Perhaps he thought he would be greeted as a prodigal son, as a returning hero, that even in a country's time of utter destruction, they would look at someone like this as at least I recognize him. He's a dictator, but he was our dictator. Kind of reminds me of the signs that have gone up of George Bush going up now on billboards. Oh, miss me yet? Perhaps he had some kind of deal he thought was going to happen. Any of those things I would just be speculating on, and I would just have to say that fortunately, this looks like a good turn of events, that a murderous gangster, a front man, a stooge for the eugenics elite, thought he was going to be greeted as a liberator, if you will, but now perhaps will hopefully face war criminal charges. And we can only hope for similar things to happen to folks like Kissinger. There's also the recent video of David Rockefeller landing somewhere in a foreign country, not in the States, I forget where it was, and he's greeted by someone at the airport basically yelling in his face saying, "You elite New World Order scum, it's never going to happen because the people are finding out." And he's a sad old, shriveled up old man So there's part of me that says, you really need to yell at an old man like that. But then the other part of me says, hell yeah, you do. That's why these elites continue to get away with things. They need to be confronted. That's why liars and war criminals like Tony Blair can't even do book appearances. I'm not sure if I've mentioned on the show yet. I may have made reference on maybe my F-book, my friend face, Jitter. There is a World Forum of Speakers of Oregon, something like that. And again, I have all this bookmarked because there's the whole spring lineup of fantastic speakers coming soon to Portland, Oregon, like Stanley McChrystal, Paul Volcker. So stay tuned, because we may be able to get into one of those and ask questions. I'm going to go for Volcker over McChrystal any day. However, my friends, that's quite a large bit of digression, and we are now into hour number two of episode 202 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's January 21st, 2011. My name is James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups, coming to you live, as always, every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. And, of course, thanks to the fine list of affiliates who carry the show, zeropointradio.com, revereradio.net, frolympia.org, berkeleyliberationradio.net, oneskyradio.com, cjsf.ca, kbu.info, radio23.org, tragedyandhope.com, corbettreport.com, groundzeromedia.org, all the other folks out there that, again, make this possible. Make this the gratifying, educational, exhilarating, maddening experience that it is running Media Monarchy. And I thank and love every one of you, and am humbled by the way that this has grown. I'm not perfect, and I sometimes need a thicker skin with some of the comments or some of the letters, or you do this and you don't do that, and I just need to concentrate on, I think, what I do well and what's made the show prosper. And I think that's why you're here. So welcome. We're going to begin this second hour with a story from Russia Today. Freeway Ricky Ross, a former U.S. street legend who, as a drug dealer, was once responsible for flooding California streets with most of its hard drugs, spoke with Russia Today about his activism against drugs. After making up to $2 million a day and then spending 20 years in prison, Freeway Ricky Ross started from scratch and is now trying to make a difference by keeping kids from following into his footsteps. We're going to listen to a snippet from an 11-minute video from Russia Today. And again, that's a great channel on YouTube to subscribe to. I know a lot of times when I'm looking for video reports on stories that I'm covering, 9 times out of 10, if I can't find it anywhere else, Russia Today did a story on it. Freeway Ricky Ross notes that Reagan and Bush let Nicaragua drugs flow free to the U.S.
What role did the U.S. government play in bringing crack cocaine into L.A.'s poor black neighborhoods?
The government needed this money to fight this war over in Nicaragua against the Sandinistas. Russia had gave the Sandinistas $100 million to fight with. Congress had cut off all the money from the Contras. So now the Sandinistas had an advantage. Reagan and Bush had made the Contras their pet peeve. They felt that if Russia took over Nicaragua, they would be too close to America. They would be in our backyard. I believe that they felt it was more valuable to sacrifice a particular sector of America and a race of people in America in order to save the whole country. So they let these guys open up pipelines. Danilo Blandon, Norman Nessus, and the rest of the crew that worked with the Nicaraguan connection, because I knew about 10 or 15 different Nicaraguans that was all inside of this, you know, Contra organization that was selling drugs. So by them allowing these guys, or basically turning a blind eye, because I don't think the government necessarily gave them the drugs or whatnot, but in a sense they sanctioned it because they turned a blind eye. They knew that these guys were selling drugs, but they did absolutely nothing about it. I also believe that had they not let these guys sell drugs, it's possible that I would have never become a drug dealer.
What does that say about our government when they're looking the other way while a deadly substance is coming into our communities for the sake of fighting a communist regime in Central America?
Well, it says that our government will sacrifice the people to accomplish a goal. And this is not the first time that they've done that. We've known numerous times in our history where they have sacrificed, especially the black man.
In that case, it's tough to hear that the ends justify the means.
They felt that it was more valuable for them to keep Russia out of America, you know, and for America to keep its way of life.
Do you think that the CIA or any other sort of government agency is still helping to funnel drugs into America?
Well, I mean, if we look at Afghanistan, you know, when the Taliban controlled Afghanistan, the flow of heroin was almost zero. And now it's up, you know, hundreds of percents more than it was at that time. So it makes you wonder, I mean, you know, what is really going on? How can the Taliban control drugs and now America can't, you know, control it? You know, heroin is on the rise again. And it's Afghanistan heroin.
The CIA connection to the Contras and the huge influx of drugs into Los Angeles wasn't exposed, wasn't made public until journalist Gary Webb started to report on it.
Gary was on a mission. You know, he didn't approve of what I did. But he said that if I was in prison, all the other players should be in prison right there with me. And that I shouldn't be used as an scapegoat. You know, he felt that justice should be level. You know what I'm saying? Not to where if you got political pull or you got money or this, that you can escape justice. And that's how Gary felt.
Everything that Gary Webb said was eventually proven to be factual. So why do you think that it was so controversial when he was actually coming out with it? And why do you think that he was attacked so much by the mainstream media?
What they really tried to attack him on is they tried to say that he said that the government deliberately put the drugs into the black community. You know, they took his words and twisted them, and I never saw where he said that he think that, you know, the Bush administration or the Reagan administration or anybody went into an office and said, hey, you know, we're gonna plan to put these drugs into the black community to destroy the community. That's not what he said. He said is that what I understood him to say is that they knew that it was taking place and that their workers, because the Contras was on the CIA payroll, so they was their employees, and that they did nothing about it.
Now, in some speeches, Gary Webb talked about how the DEA told him that what he was reporting on would put people's lives at risk. Now, do you think that was just a scare tactic? And are there parallels from what was happening then to what is happening right now? Today in the news, we hear about WikiLeaks exposing all these U.S. military secrets. And we're also hearing on the news that these secrets are supposedly putting people's lives at risk. I mean, talk about the similarities.
I mean, our government is really out of control. You know, DEA, FBI, they're really out of control. Nobody, I mean, like, when we find wrongdoing in our cases and stuff, there was nobody that we could run to and say, hey, you know, this guy is doing such and such and such and such. You know, even with the crooked cops, there was nobody we could go to express what was going on, that these cops were beating us. You know, these cops busted my head open and with flashlights. They let a dog bite me while I was handcuffed. But there was nobody that we could go to and express what was going on.
Freeway Ricky Ross, Reagan Bush let Nicaragua drugs flow free to the U.S. and added, as a flashback to the bottom of this post, is a fantastic documentary which we've covered a few times in the past on Media Monarchy. It was made by Kevin Booth, who goes back to the Sacred Cow crew out of Austin, Texas, with Alex Jones and Bill Hicks and others. His documentary, American Drug War, The Last White Hope, is available in its entirety on Google Video, and we supply you that link. But just so you know how far back we were covering this story, our first mention of one of the original versions of this documentary, American Drug War, The Last White Hope, goes back to November 2006 on MediaMonarchy.com. So there are our drug war stories for you, my friends, as we now move to the news purge. That's right, the January 20th news purge, you and me and the war of the end times. That line taken from our opening song of this episode 202, brand new music from the Decemberists, Calamity Song. We'll begin, as always, on the news purge with the latest 9/11 updates, where, here it is, Daniel Pearl was beheaded by 9/11 mastermind KSM. Daniel Pearl was beheaded by the 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, according to an FBI forensic test, which matched veins on his hands with one in the video of the journalist's murder. The analysis is disclosed in a three-year independent investigation into the killing, which casts further doubt on the conviction of British conspirator Omar Sheikh Saeed for the murder of Mr. Pearl. The Pearl Project concludes Pakistani authorities knowingly used perjured testimony to pin the murder on the former public schoolboy. Mr. Pearl was kidnapped in the Pakistani port of Karachi on January 23, 2002, while researching Islamic militants, and 4 weeks later, a video of his execution was delivered to American officials. While Sheikh and the other three convicted of the killing were involved in the kidnapping, they were not in the room when the Wall Street Journal reporter was murdered, it found. He had been seized and held in a multifaceted, at times chaotic conspiracy involving at least 27 men from three militant groups. Only 14 of those have been arrested, and Mr. Pearl's actual murderers are unlikely to ever face trial, the investigation found. After his kidnapped, he was handed to an Al-Qaeda gang led by KSM, a strategist for the terror network who killed him. The inquiry by academics, journalists, and students involved hundreds of interviews with American and Pakistani officials. KSM was captured in March 03 and confessed to masterminding the 9/11 attacks, in addition to claiming responsibility for planning events he couldn't have possibly planned because the buildings didn't exist. Pinning everything on KSM now. The grand boogeyman for all things 9/11 related. A man who has been so brutalized and tortured, he would admit to killing Sharon Tate. A great way to put this into perspective, and what this story immediately reminded me of, is the fantastic docudrama Who Killed John O'Neill, where ISI plus CIA equals the death of Daniel Pearl.
Where is ISI in the official story?
The official story of 9/11 implicates a man named Omar Sheikh Saeed as the paymaster for lead hijacker Mohammed Atta, and a man named Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is the operational mastermind behind the attacks. Both men are well-known ISI agents.
How do I know the name Saeed?
Well, probably because he's one of the most infamous terrorists known to man. You may know him by another name, too, because he has about a half dozen aliases. But his big claim to fame is his conviction for the kidnapping and murder of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl in February of 2002.
Daniel Pearl was killed by an ISI agent?
By the very man the government claims assisted in the 9/11 attacks. Pearl was on his way to meet Saeed when he disappeared. Saeed, using one of his aliases, knew that Pearl was investigating ISI ties to Al-Qaeda and 9/11.
I thought Pearl was killed because he was Jewish.
But it's far more likely he was killed by a high-ranking ISI agent to make sure he didn't print in a major U.S. newspaper ISI's connections to Al-Qaeda.
Because that, in turn, would implicate the CIA.
Well, think about it. If Al-Qaeda is funded by the ISI, and the ISI is funded by the CIA, 2 plus 2 is 4.
And there you have it. If you have not seen Ty Rauber's amazing film, Who Killed John O'Neill, do yourself an educational favor and go watch that documentary. Our other couple of 9/11 related notes, A recent poll shows that 89.5% of Germans don't believe the official 9/11 story. And our last note is a sad one from FireRescue1.com. FDNY firefighter William Henry Quick dies at the age of 55 from 9/11 related injuries. But the EPA said the air was safe to breathe. And they have to beg and fight and plead and prostrate themselves before their Congress critters to get any kind of money, any kind of funding. We move now to our BioWars EnviroHealth updates. And the first we take from The Lookout. Scientists warn California could be struck by a winter superstorm. A group of more than 100 scientists and experts say in a new report that California faces the risk of a massive superstorm that could flood a quarter of the state's homes and cause $300 to $400 billion in damage. Researchers point out that the potential scale of destruction in this storm scenario is 4 or 5 times the amount of damage that could be wrought by a major earthquake. It seems like the plot of an apocalyptic action movie, but scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey warn federal and state emergency officials that California's geological history shows such superstorms have happened in the past and should be added to the long list of natural disasters to worry about in the Golden State. Surely there'll be some National Geographic Learning Channel docudrama threataganda predictive programming piece to come very soon, if there isn't already. Meanwhile, down the list from BioWars EnviroHealth updates, U.S. rejects call to destroy smallpox stockpile. This is from BioPrepWatch.com, and it notes, hey, we still need to experiment on those. GlaxoSmithKline sets aside $3.4 billion to cover their mounting legal costs. More on that from allgov.com. Banned toxic chemicals found in 100% of pregnant women. That's from naturalnews.com. And from thebigwobble.com, the die-offs continue. 200 dead cows found in a Wisconsin field.
New at 10, the Portage County Humane Society is investigating the death of 200 cows. The cattle were discovered at a field on 4th Avenue in the town of Stockton. The owner had been working with a veterinarian. It's believed the animals died of a virus that can cause respiratory and reproductive problems. Samples from the dead animals have been sent to Madison for testing. Investigators say there is no threat to people or other animals.
Since we're discussing, yet again, the ongoing mass animal die-off meme, and it's more than a meme, it's very tangible and frightening. We've been covering this story now for the last few weeks on MediaMonarchy.com, but recently Natural News put up a very handy and updated timeline of these mysterious animal deaths. And let's run down the list so we can wrap our heads around this. December 13th, thousands of dead fish wash up in Australia. December 15th, thousands of dead fish wash up in Florida. December 17th, dead fish wash ashore in Indiana. December 18th, thousands of dead fish turn up in a bay in Philippines. Unknown causes. December 22nd, more than 100 dead pelicans turn up in North Carolina. Unknown causes. December 23rd, 10 tons of mostly dead fish found in a fishing net in New Zealand. Unknown causes. December 23rd, hundreds of dead sea creatures wash ashore in South Carolina. December 27th, scores of dead fish wash ashore in a lake in Haiti. December 28th, 70 bats found dead in Tucson, Arizona. December 29th, dozens of dead fish found in San Antonio. December 31st, and this is where it really kicked in, 5,000 plus birds found dead in Alabama, suffering from massive trauma and blood clots. January 3rd, 100 plus thousand dead fish found in Arkansas River. January 3rd, 100 tons of dead fish wash ashore in Brazil. Also, on the 3rd, tens of thousands of dead fish wash ashore in the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland, blamed on cold water. again on January 3rd, dozens of dead birds show up in a woman's backyard in Kentucky. And then to the 4th, hundreds of dead blackbirds in Louisiana, hundreds of dead fish in Ontario, thousands of dead fish in Florida, several dead manatees on Florida coast, up to 100 jackdaw birds found dead in Sweden, large amount of dead fish wash up on New Zealand beaches, hundreds of dead birds found on a highway in Texas, 40,000 plus dead crabs wash ashore in the UK, 1,000 dead turtle doves found in Italy. Now we're up to January 8th. Dozens of dead starlings turn up in Romania. Then happens in California, again with 100 dead starlings. Countless fish found dead in a UK brook on the 10th. On the 11th, thousands of fish float to the top of Lake Michigan, blamed on cold weather. On the 13th, 300 birds found dead on a highway in Alabama, blamed on blunt force trauma. January 14th, 730 African gray parrots die during flight, blamed on possible exposure to carbon monoxide. 100 dead carp found in a UK pond, and 200 cows found dead in Wisconsin, allegedly caused by a virus. There is your updated timeline of mysterious animal deaths up to January 14th. Big thanks to naturalnews.com for putting that together. We now move to Econo Crash updates, and we could have probably included these as we're covering the takeover of the United States. WikiLeaks given 2,000 secret bank files at a very theatrical press conference. More on that from the Sydney Morning Herald as we brace to see what happens with their bankster dump. U.S. starts to call in loans to states for unemployment benefits. That's from allgov.com and from dailybail.com. Bankruptcy of the U.S. is a mathematical certainty, or so says a professor and former CEO of the nation's 10th largest bank.
But then there's a larger, the overarching debt problem of the U.S. government in general. As of Friday, the U.S., the total U.S. debt was $13.66 trillion. For the third year in a row, we've had a deficit, an annual federal budget deficit that exceeded $1 trillion. The federal government borrowed $1.655 trillion. As I mentioned, Obama has borrowed $3 trillion since his inauguration day. And according to the Treasury Department's projections, as analyzed by the Peterson Foundation, the country faces a long-term $61.9 trillion unfunded liability, which they mean money that we potentially owe in entitlement benefits such as Social Security, Medicare, people now alive that they do not believe will be met by the current tax structure and revenue we bring in. How do we deal with this overall fiscal problem that the United States faces as a nation?
Yeah, that's a very, very important question. I think the first thing we have to realize is where we're going and to face it objectively. If you run the numbers on all those numbers you just talked about, which I think are accurate, very accurate, in 20 or 25 years, the United States goes bankrupt. It's a mathematical certainty. It reminds me very much of that story I told you about Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. We were running the numbers, and Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae went bankrupt, and we got there. In 20, 25 years, the United States goes bankrupt. Now, countries don't go bankrupt the way companies do. They don't file bankruptcy. They usually hyperinflate. They print a bunch of paper money, or they become third world economies like Argentina, unless we change direction. So we absolutely have to change direction. And the irony of that is it requires an interesting combination. It requires both discipline, but it also requires a focus on growing our economy. And it means almost a fundamental philosophical change from where we are today, from the idea of redistributing wealth to the idea of creating wealth.
Put pretty simply, from folks who would know what they're talking about, the bankruptcy of the U.S. is a mathematical certainty. And even says, gosh, it's almost as if we're going to be turned into a third world nation. The question you must inevitably reach, and I hope that this is the question that masses of people are reaching, that as they're discovering and learning about these things that are going on in the world, thanks to this Gutenberg revolution where we're able to spread information like never before in the history of humankind, you have to come to the question of, this can't be happening by accident. These things can't all be converging by happenstance. if you subscribe to the accidental theory of history, you would have to surmise that, well, geez, this should benefit me once in a while. But we don't subscribe to that. We canceled our subscription to that, as you should to any banksters that hold your money and loan out $10 for every one you give them. I, unfortunately, as we were discussing the Comcast takeover of the National Broadcasting Corporation, I unfortunately have Comcast and see no real alternative in the present, because as it goes, I run a bunch of websites and do a lot of online media uploading and downloading, and I kind of need a steady, stable internet connection. But let's continue down the news purge. You and me in the War of the End Times for a couple of history mystery notes. Kenny Sideshow blog gets into the what if surrounding yesterday's 50th anniversary of the inauguration of John F. Kennedy. We can play those what if games till the cows come home, but I think we've already worked out the answers, and those point back to the main moves that all of my study has shown, that Kennedy was going to end and not expand the war in Vietnam. He was going to start to cut out the Federal Reserve, and he's going to disband the CIA. Any one of those things would lead to the death of a president. And it was done high noon, broad daylight on the 33rd parallel. King Kill 33, if you will. But that's not the first, or rather the last anniversary we're going to mention on this news purge, but the other one's going to come at the bottom. But if you think about, if it was the 50th anniversary of JFK's inauguration just the other day, what would be the 50th anniversary of something just a couple of days before that? Our other history mystery note follows the story, or updates a story we've been following for the last several weeks. Now, Oswald's brother is suing over the sale of Lee Harvey Oswald's coffin, which we noted to you was going up for auction. I believe we reported last week that even the ambulance that carried JFK from Andrews Air Force Base to the Bethesda Naval Hospital, that's also going up for auction. But that story comes from clicktohouston.com. And we now, unfortunately, move to our murder and mayhem, where the media buries the "you're dead" threat by a leftist against a Tea Party leader. While the establishment media continues to run with the hoax that violent political rhetoric, Tea Partiers and the Second Amendment were responsible for the Tucson, Arizona assassination event, leftists continue to brazenly issue death threats against anyone who disagrees with them, with the press complicit in burying the story. For over a week, pro-Obama lefty blogs, and of course foundation-funded outlets like Huffington Post and Daily Cause and Media Matters, enthusiastically backed up by the likes of the New York Times and the AP, blamed vitriolic conservative political rhetoric for the massacre that killed six and seriously wounded Congresswoman Gifford, despite the fact that shooter Jared Loughner was a lefty, and perhaps a cultist, and perhaps cross-dresser. In the meantime, the only vitriolic rhetoric witnessed has come from the mouths of the very vultures who are seeking to exploit the tragedy to ram through their control freak agenda to shut down free speech and eviscerate the Second Amendment. After the media blamed Tea Party figurehead Sarah Palin for the shooting, she was bombarded by scores of vile and obscene death threats, with a link for you. Following a taping of ABC's This Week, a liberal angry that Tucson Tea Party leader Trent Humphreys disagreed with his call for draconian gun control laws, directly identified Humphreys, took his picture, and then shouted, "You're dead." At least according to Pima County Sheriff's Office, who subsequently arrested J. Eric Fuller, charged him with a misdemeanor, and had him involuntarily committed for psychiatric evaluation. There is a clip to go along with this, and of course, you can follow all the other foundation-funded outlets like Democracy Now! For this story that, again, is perfectly written for the fake left-right paradigm. This entire Loughner-Giffords psyop, and that's exactly what it is. It's a psychological operation, as so many of these things are. It's a war on your consciousness.
and you can see which side is in favor and which side plays defense and which side is energized and which side goes to sleep. And it's all about the fake dichotomy that keeps this disgusting system propped up. Rockers, anti-flag, and drowning pool quell speculation about motivating Loeffner. That coming from Big Hollywood, one of the Breitbart conservative blogs. An interesting report from William H. Kennedy, who has been a guest on Clyde Lewis's GroundZeroMedia.org, has a new article on SphinxRadio.com on the possible satanic sacrifice at Safeway, an ongoing investigation into the Arizona assassinations. Lauren Coleman of Copycat Effect gets into the Loeffner and space coincidences. Of course, Giffords is an astronaut's wife, and Loeffner was obsessed with space. Big Dan Blogger.blogspot.com gets into all the other connecting murder and mayhem psyop memes going on over the last several weeks, connecting and getting into Wheeler. Ashley Turton, who we reported to you last week, died in a suspicious car fire in her garage. Loeffner and even Tunisia. Lauren Coleman also gets into some of the immolation copycats going on around the world, and I even just saw a report coming out of India. I highly recommend the book from Lauren Coleman, The Copycat Effect. I got a cheap used copy off Amazon for just a couple bucks. Two California students wounded when a gun in their backpack discharges. Reports from USA Today and the New York Post, assault with deadly weapon charges expected. And, of course, it's another gun story leading to crazed panic lockdowns of schools and all of these things. As the heat seems to be turned up. We'll end our murder and mayhem on the most disgusting note possible, I believe, or at least this week. We'll take it from ABC. Philadelphia abortion doctor killed 7 babies with scissors.
Lawmen say this woman's health clinic was in fact a house of horrors. Prosecutors say the state ignored complaints of barbaric conditions inside. And the doctor whose name is on the door, Kermit Gosnell, has now been charged with 8 counts of murder. 7 of his alleged victims were only minutes old. The alleged murder weapon, a pair of scissors. It is Wednesday night, and the big story on Action News tonight is a grand jury report detailing horrible allegations against the abortion doctor and the place he called his office, an alleged house of horrors. Action News reporter Brian Taff is live at 38 and Lancaster with the full story. Brian?
And Jim, the details laid out in that grand jury report you just mentioned, I have here are the stuff of nightmares. Allegations that a West Philadelphia abortion doctor induced labor, delivered near full-term babies, then savagely killed them. Tonight, that doctor is charged with 8 counts of murder. The lawyer for the lone adult victim says the deaths were absolutely brutal, and the city's district attorney says the state should have stopped them.
But they didn't. And as Cryptogon.com noted, this must be a far deeper entrenched goings-on for this to go on so long. Looking the other way, while an eugenics agenda plays out. Almost reminding me of something like Saw or Hostel or Human Centipede or something. Our couple of Obama Sia notes that, again, we probably could have posted along with all the Obama China news. Obama DOJ defends marriage for man and woman only. That's from allgov.com. Sorry, left. Are you realizing yet that this Wall Street puppet doesn't care about you and was only too happy to take your money and take your dreams put upon him in the most amazing Madison Avenue PSYOP presidential campaign we've ever seen? How much longer are you going to go along with this? How much longer are you going to tacitly approve of this? At least take off your stupid bumper sticker. Jeez. The other Obamasiah update is an amazing hour-long show from Lone Lantern, youtube.com/Lone Lantern. That's Gary Franchi of Restore the Republic, getting into Rahm Emanuel and the Chicago Political Syndicate, a symphony of corruption. I wish we could play the entire thing. This is the story. This is the way to flesh out what we see. And again, yes, they're front men. Does Rahm Emanuel run anything? Of course not. But he's a very important mover and shaker and front man, and of course, quite well-heeled and connected from Chicago to Tel Aviv. We now move to our Police State International updates, where from threat level, or rather danger room, on Wired First, Homeland Security junks billion-dollar virtual fence. It only took nearly a year of hiatus and $1 billion in sunk costs, but the Department of Homeland Security has finally gotten rid of the networked suite of sensors that made up its virtual border fence, but some of its technology may live on as zombie border protection. The virtual fence cannot meet its original objective of providing a single integrated border security technology solution. Secretary Big Sister Janet Napolitano conceded in a statement heralding the program's termination. Boeing's SBINet was supposed to be the ultimate in anti-illegal immigrant technology. Miles of surveillance radar towers, colloquially called cameras on a pole, hooked up to ground-based sensors that detected the heat of someone's footprints or the metal of a border-crossing vehicle. Sound impractical? That's what the Government Accountability Office found in October when it lamented SBINet's well-chronicled history of not delivering promised capabilities and benefits on time and within budget. And you can download that PDF. We'll also note that Boeing made a huge deal for weapons with China, and then a couple days later immediately turned around and fired 1,000 people in the States. And the agenda rolls forward. FBI arrest 127 mobsters in the biggest ever crackdown in New York. Taking it from across the pond from the Telegraph, but God, I thought Hoover said the mob didn't exist. More on that guy in a little bit. FBI says a bomb placed at a Spokane, Washington MLK Day parade was indeed domestic terrorism, or homegrown errorism, as we've coined it here. Big Sister, speaking of Napolitano, and again, she's just a crony carrying out the agenda she's been handed. They've now launched new DHS takeovers of hotels, malls, and stadiums. Homeland Stupidity released a trio of chilling PSAs in which ordinary everyday activities are characterized as signs of potential terrorism, with the public being indoctrinated to assume the role of domestic spies reporting on their friends and neighbors as America sinks deeper and deeper into a decaying police state. Now, you can get these from Federal JackTube 3 on YouTube. But I took the 3 10-minute-long videos and put them into a playlist, which you can get on my YouTube channel. Meanwhile, from WTOP.com, the District of Criminals wants access to thousands more surveillance cameras. D.C.'s Homeland Stupidity Department is pressing for access to more security cameras, including ones owned by private businesses and Metro. The D.C. Homeland Security and Emergency Management Agency submitted a plan to tap into private cameras, such as those found at banks or outside office buildings, as well as those at public housing developments, according to the Washington Examiner. The agency already has access to more than 4,500 cameras owned by D.C. transportation and school systems. If approved, the plan would grant the Homeland Security Department access to thousands more cameras. And to wrap up our police state updates, and a way to put a button on all of these stories, an amazing 95-minute interview with legendary actor, political activist, and leader for the American Indian Movement, Russell Means. Welcome to the reservation. The United States is one big reservation, and we're all in it. Russell Means led the 1972 seizure of the Bureau of Indian Affairs headquarters in D.C., and in 1973 led a standoff at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, a response to the massacre of at least 150 Lakota men, women, and children by the U.S. 7th Cavalry at a camp near Wounded Knee. That interview is, of course, from InfoWars. Speaking of wars, we get to our War Whores updates, and we mentioned the anniversary a few minutes ago. Did you figure out what the other one was? 50th anniversary of Eisenhower's military-industrial complex speech. And as our foundation-funded friends at HuffingtonPost.com note, it is still shocking on many levels. I believe I saw a few other articles, but I unfortunately don't have linked up for you, that noted how a few sentences out of context in a farewell speech does not remove what went on in his previous years as president. 25 tons of bombs wipe Afghan town off the map. That's from Danger Room with a disgusting before and after photo. And I believe the update is Petraeus said, "The Taliban made us do it." Which reminds us of Bill Hicks riffing on Shane with Jack Palance, where you throw the gun down in front of the poor sheep herder kid and said, "Pick up the gun." Seymour Hersh notes that many within Joint Special Operations Command are, quote, members of, or at least supporters of, Knights of Malta. Again, huge thanks to Cryptogon.com for finding that bit in that story. And as we've noted here, Cryptogon.com is one of the best alternative media sites out there. And at least for myself, a model of what Media Monarchy would like to grow to become, to the point where it's supported by the audience, the listeners and the fans and the people who donate or buy related media, which you get a kickback on or sign up with the hosting or any of those number of things. Those are the things, and even sites like Red Ice Radio with the free show every week, but also the paid special show. Great ideas and great business models in this new financial world order. Our last War Whore note, again, allgov.com, and we take many, many stories from them. They're a fantastic website, and I enjoy their quick distillation of news stories with simple sourcing. And I'll also remind you, we interviewed last year the editor-in-chief and founder of AllGov.com, David Walachinsky. But we're at the bottom of the list now of the January 20th news purge, You and Me and the War of the End Times, West Virginia Worry. And we take our first story from KOAMTV.com. Activist dismayed by Manchin plan to curb EPA. An environmental activist says Senator Joe Manchin's first bill should aim to ban mountaintop removal coal mining, not rein in the Environmental Protection Agency. The new West Virginia senator, former governor, Joe Manchin, announced Thursday he's crafting legislation to prevent the EPA from retroactively vetoing Clean Water Act permits, as it did last week with Arch Coal's Spruce No. 1 mine in Logan County. The agency ruled it would cause irreparable environmental damage and threaten the health of communities. Bo Webb of Coal River Mountain Watch says Manchin should put his constituents' health first and seek an immediate ban on mountaintop removal mining in West Virginia. He says Manchin and other politicians should stop supporting activity that makes coalfield residents sick from air and water pollution. Manchin's first bill as a brand new senator, working against the best interests of the people of West Virginia. So speaking of that, Judy Bonds, age 58, enemy of mountaintop removal coal mining, has died ankle deep in the stream by the house where his coal mining family had lived for generations. Judy Bonds' six-year-old grandson, Andrew, scoops up fistfuls of dead fish one day back in 96. "What's wrong with these fish?" he said. "I knew something was very, very wrong," Miss Bonds told Sierra Magazine in 2003, "so I began to open my eyes and pay attention." Ms. Bond soon discovered that the fish had been poisoned by debris from the mines in the mountains above the West Virginia Hollow where her family had lived since early last century. Within 6 years, she and her Marfork Hollow neighbors had to abandon their homes. Judy Bonds joined in 2001, I believe, Coal River Mountain Watch as a volunteer, the aforementioned. Connecting up almost to our present day with last year's deadly explosion killing 29 miners, the nation's worst mining disaster in 40 years, I implore you to go back to episode 165 of MediaMonarchy.com, one of our most popular episodes where we have an interview with Reverend Billy on the Mountaintop Revival, and there's even an exclusive interview with my dad. Public has questions for Chemical Safety Board. This story from WOWKTV.com. More than 200 people attended a public hearing at West Virginia State University. Area residents, students, and community leaders packed into a conference room at West Virginia State University as the United States Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board revealed the findings of their research into the August 2008 explosion at the Bayer Crop Science Facility at the Institute. Shay Strother is a student at West Virginia State. She said she was alarmed by what she heard, greatly concerned about our safety. We supply the flashback for you to MediaMonarchy.com. September 2008, Bayer pesticide factory explosion in West Virginia kills one, and we will always remind you that our Nazi friends at Bayer not only helped facilitate the Holocaust with their Zyklon B, they also sold AIDS-tainted Factor VIII drugs overseas, and they continue to do their eugenics GM agenda with their crop science branch, helping destroy and kill my home state of West Virginia. That's the end of the January 20th News Purge, You and Me and the War of the End Times, and we reach our final post here on episode 202 from MediaMonarchy.com with an article from Kurt Nimmo, and we bring it back home the way we started the episode with brand new music from Portland, Oregon's own The Decemberists. Contrived tree bomber plot to stampede Portland into an FBI takeover. Residents of Portland, Oregon recently attended a forum, it was two Thursdays ago, on the question of whether the city should rejoin the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. The city withdrew its task force membership 5 years ago after the Justice Department turned down a city request for oversight over the JTTF. The decision followed revelations in 2002 that the FBI and the Portland police kept thousands of Red Squad-style police files on political activists. Link to Wikipedia on this Red Squad story. Since 1981, Oregon law has barred police surveillance of political groups in the absence of criminal activity. We do have a link over to We Are Change Portland, attending and asking important questions and bringing up the, of course, apparent connections that we've gone over in Media Monarchy's study of the tree bomber PSYOP. Happened on Black Friday here in Portland. That video is posted up thanks to my man Mike, who also helps run GroundZeroTV.org. An op-ed published in the Oregonian last week argues in favor of a resumption of FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force activities in Portland. The obviously staged Christmas tree terror plot was mentioned. Quote, "The averted attack during Portland's Christmas tree lighting ceremony has touched off a debate about the city's decision 6 years ago to withdraw from the task force. That withdrawal was clearly unwise." End quote. The FBI orchestrated event was cooked up not only as yet another sideshow in the never-ending war against manufactured terror, but also as a stunt to frighten the people of Portland into accepting the presence of the FBI and, of course, all their connected private military contractor compartmentalized police state operatives. If the FBI is allowed back into Portland, the city's residents can expect the agency, acting as America's political police force, to resume its efforts to attack the establishment's political enemies, as Poppy Bush called Portland on one of his very few visits to the city, Little Beirut. The FBI does not exist to combat kidnappers and bank robbers as advertised, although, as we just reported to you, they'll make a big show out of busting some gangsters. It exists to neutralize and destroy all political opposition, as its former director, cross-dressing J. Edgar Hoover, so famously said when the counterintelligence program was rolled out 50 years ago. COINTELPRO. Here today. So again, my friends, I implore you to go grab that video from We Are Change Portland, mentioning, of course, the 93 World Trade Center bombing event, getting that on the record. I believe the story is that they're going to make a decision about rejoining the task force by or on February 24th. So anybody within the Portland area can make a quick, easy phone call to Mayor Sam Adams. We, of course, include our flashback link to our main posting covering this story on MediaMonarchy.com. Tree bomber brings homegrown paranoia to Oregon, and we did do many interviews and other related media appearances. We discussed this on Ground Zero with Clyde Lewis. We discussed this on Red Ice Radio with Henrik Palmgren. And we have our other related Oregon oddities, as we call them. Father-son spy drama ends with dad's 8-year sentence. This comes from Threat Level, and we've reported briefly just a few times on this story. A disgraced CIA agent serving 23 years for being a Russian spy was handed 8 more years Tuesday for hiring his son to collect overdue bills linked to his father's nefarious espionage activities. The 59-year-old father, Harold Nicholson, had enlisted his now 26-year-old son, the youngest of 3, to collect his unpaid bills from the Russians. The son flew from Portland to numerous destinations, including San Francisco, Mexico City, Peru, and Cyprus, bringing back tens of thousands of dollars in cash, and the money was dispersed to family members. It was the first U.S. spy case in which a jailed spy was convicted again of espionage involving the same country. You can download the PDF to learn more about this case of Harold Nicholson, the father-son spy drama now ending, or the ending of the beginning, here in Portland. A story that was originally published in December, but I had missed, and a huge thanks to whoever reminded me of it. And again, huge thanks to the folks who send me news tips, and I implore you to do so, MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. And of course, you can also leave comments on any of the number of sites that we're all spread out on. It comes from CapitalPress.com. Investigators baffled as wheat fields wither in Umatilla County near the chemical weapons depot. Daryl Hannah fights human trafficking deniers in Oregon. And I realize I got ahead of myself. We do have a quick news blast, not the clip from We Are Change at the town hall meeting discussing the Joint Terrorism Task Force, but just the quick report from KGW. So let's pick it up.
Portlanders packed a forum at PSU to weigh in on a crucial question. Should the city rejoin the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force or stay out? The forum was the first in a series set up by Mayor Sam Adams after the failed plot to blow up Pioneer Courthouse Square. Brandon Mayfield attended last night. He is the local attorney the FBI falsely linked to the Madrid train bombing. Mayfield fears rejoining the task force could give police more power to intrude in private lives.
For the most part, I think I'm cautious and probably rightfully so, based on what's happened to myself and my family and other members in the local community.
Mayor Adams has scheduled a vote on the Joint Terrorism Task Force for Thursday, February 24th.
Ah, remember Brandon Mayfield? See, these stories, even though they're happening in my backyard, help elucidate what's going on all around the world. So getting back to where we were on the rest of our related Oregon oddities, Daryl Hannah fights human trafficking deniers in Oregon and at our own Oregonian newspaper. She even rode along with the Portland police to help expose child sex trafficking in the city, referred to sometimes as Pornland.
Hollywood actress Daryl Hannah has long been an activist against child sex trafficking overseas. Now she's on a mission right here. This weekend, she rode with Portland police officers, and News Channel 8's Wayne Haverly caught up with her at a conference against sex trafficking.
Daryl Hannah has many stories to share about modern-day slavery. At the Northwest Conference Against Human Trafficking, she shared her experience of going undercover into brothels in places like Cambodia to make a documentary on human sex trafficking. Saturday night, she rode along with Portland police and says she was shocked at what she learned about the sex industry in our all-American city, best known for roses.
Most of the girls in these clubs aren't independent contractors. They're not girls just going to look to make some cash. The majority of them are represented by pimps.
To go out on 82nd.
Like Hannah, Senator Ron Wyden recently went on a ride along with anti-sex trafficking officers. What he saw convinced him to push Congress to help local survivors of human sex trafficking. He's co-sponsored a bill to fight the problem and talked about it last Friday during a town hall meeting.
We're going to get passed early this year. There's going to be help for shelters for young women so they can get their lives back together.
The team has learned that there are no shelters. It was specifically for victims of trafficking is absolutely shocking. I mean, that in the whole country, there's less than 100 beds for victims of trafficking.
According to FBI estimates, more than 100,000 underage girls are exploited for commercial sex in the U.S. every year. Those at this conference believe it can be stopped by raising awareness and working together. Wayne Haverly, KGW, News Channel 8.
Wyden's bill would authorize $2 million grants to six separate areas known for child sex trafficking. Portland would likely be one of those areas.
And it's interesting to note that Daryl Hannah's been an activist in not only my current city of Portland, but also in my home state of West Virginia. Being an activist, even being arrested alongside RFK Jr. fighting mountaintop removal. There you have it, my friends. That's everything under the sun in the media monarchy kingdom growing every day, and it's all thanks to you. So before we go out, I'll wrap it up right here and say, my name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster and humble servant behind MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you, as always, from the Portland Radio Authority. This has been episode 202 for January 21st, 2011, and we'll end on a fun note. We began with brand new music from Portland's Decemberists with their new record, The King is Dead, and we'll end with a song from the television show that premieres tonight on IFC. It's called Portlandia. It's Carrie Brownstein, ex of Slater Kinney, Fred Armisen of Saturday Night Live. It's produced by Lorne Michaels. It's put out by Broadway Video, who also did Kids in the Hall. And it's going to shed some kind of light on our city. I'm sure some are bracing themselves for possible repercussions that something like this is going to bring. So with all those things we've seen, my friends, all the things we've gone over on this episode, we can at least tongue-in-cheek, lightheartedly joke that, well, at least the dream of the 90s is alive in Portlandia. Ladies and gentlemen, as always, I implore you, don't hate the media. Become the media. Take care.
Melanie.
Oh, hey, Jason.
Hey, what's going on?
Not much. I didn't know you were back in L.A.
Yeah, yeah.
What?
Had a pretty amazing trip. I mean, it was unreal.
Really? I can't wait to hear about it.
No, I have, like, a lot to tell you.
What is it?
It's fine. Do you remember the 90s?
Yeah.
You know, people were talking about getting piercings and getting tribal tattoos.
Yeah.
And people were singing about saving the planet and forming bands.
Yeah.
There's a place where that idea still exists as a reality. And I've been there.
Where is it?
Portland.
Oregon?
Yeah.
Dream of the 90s alive. Portland, Portland. Dream of the 90s is alive, Portland, Portland.
Tattoo ink never runs dry. Remember when people were content to be unambitious, to sleep till 11, just hang out with their friends. I mean, he had no occupations whatsoever, maybe working a couple hours a week at a coffee shop.
Right. I thought that died out a long time ago.
Not in Portland. Portland is a city where young people go to retire.
Dream of the 90s is alive in Portland. All the hot girls wear glasses.
Yeah. Remember in the 90s when they encouraged you to be weird? It was just an amazing time where people would go to see something like the Jim Rose Sideshow Circus and watch someone hang something from their penis. You could grow up to want to be a clown. People went to clown school.
I gave up clowning years ago.
Well, in Portland, you don't have to.
Dream of the 90s is alive in Portland. The dream of the 90s is alive in Portland.
The dream is alive.
So from what I can surmise from what you're positing, it's like Portland's almost an alternative universe. It's like Gore won. The Bush administration never happened.
Exactly.
In Portland, it's almost like cars don't exist, right?
Yes.
They ride bikes or double-decker bikes. They ride unicycles.
Yes.
They ride the tram. They ride skateboards.
Yes.
Dream of the 90s is alive. My flannel shirt still looks white. Dream of the 90s is alive in Portland, Portland. Dream of the 90s is alive in Portland, Portland.
Portland, you can go to like a record store and sell your CDs.
Turn that dirty clown frown right upside down.
Portland, you can put a bird on something and just call it art.
The dream of the 90s is alive in Portland, Portland. The dream of the 90s.
I made it.
Yeah, you're a little late.
Sorry.
You're also a little San Francisco right now, if you know what I mean. Try to. Sorry. Much better. Welcome to Portland.
Thank you.
The dream of the 90s is alive in Portland.
I just want to cut in here with a quick addendum for a story I forgot to tell on the live show, and because Portlandia premieres tonight, now is exactly the time to tell this story. The other day at work, I had a coworker come up to me and say, "Hey, I was on YouTube looking up Portlandia clips, and video of you came up. Why is that?" And I laughed and said, because I am a savvy media maven. Back in October, the 50th episode of New World Next Week, where we went over Portlandia Crime Haven, I asked James Corbett to name the YouTube clip Portlandia Crime Haven so we could capitalize ahead of time on what I knew was coming, and that's the premiere of Portlandia. So there you go, my friends.
MediaMonarchy.com is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Featuring weekly radio shows on the Portland Radio Authority, PRAradio.org, the New World Next Week video series with CorbettReport.com, plus special interview episodes, B-sides, mixtapes, and so much more. Send news tips to MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. You can make a donation, or mail media to the Monarchy, at P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon 97212. Thanks to all the internet and community radio stations who broadcast these shows, and most of all, thanks to you. Remember, don't hate the media, become the media.
Whether you went on with the diary, or whether you did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.